We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
It's time for MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Host a local event and give kids in your community a chance to compete in the Pitch, Hit, and Run Finals at the 2024 MLB World Series. Sign up for free at pitchhitrun.com.
Good morning, and welcome to another edition of Better Living, a show about people and organizations making an impact around Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm your host, Chris Arnold of 105.3 The Fan. Thanks for joining me. And our first guest is Amy Jones, CEO of the Dallas Area Rape Crisis Center. Amy, good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm great. Thank you.
It's a pleasure talking to you because there are so many questions a lot of people have, but they are afraid to ask about. And I'm sure you've got quite a few answers for a lot of people out there. April, ironically, was Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Can you talk about what happened this past month and how the Dallas Area Rape Crisis Center was making sure people were aware of it?
Sure. So, yes, April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month across the nation. Advocates in the fight together to address the impact of sexual violence and bring an end to the epidemic of sexual violence, we all come together and we just focus in April and make sure that we double down on our efforts. Of course, when you work in a rape crisis center, this is what we're doing all the time, but we really depend on a lot of the community awareness and engagement during the month of April to help folks who maybe have never heard of us, who need to hear of us, have access to us and the information that they might need to address perhaps what's happened in their own lives. So in Sexual Assault Awareness Month, my gosh, we had a number of community events. Mm-hmm. I have an incredible team of educators who go out into the community on a regular basis, and they're engaging with folks in the community. They're talking about sexual violence. They're talking about root causes of sexual violence. They're talking about how you can support someone who discloses to you that they have experienced sexual violence. So we were all over the place in the month of April. We had our fourth annual community breakfast on Friday morning, the 30th. It was our first in-person event since the beginning of this pandemic. It was outside. We gathered together with a number of folks who were really stakeholders, community partners with us in this effort to address and to end sexual violence. Had a great time. Got together, had breakfast, tacos, coffee. Some folks just drove through. Some folks parked and mingled. Mm-hmm. So it was a really, really good month. But, you know, just because the month is over does not mean that the work ends. We continue, and we do that because we recognize this is an issue that needs attention all the time. And this is what those of us here at the Rape Crisis Center have really committed our life to doing, so that we can change the experience of those who have and who know sexual violence personally, and hopefully reduce the potential impact of sexual violence in the future, meaning we really want to work ourselves out of a job.
I hear you. And it's all about education, and it's also about the various degrees of sexual assault. Sometimes people only assume sexual assault is the violent rape act, and there's actual degrees of it, but it's still the individual's body that's being violated. And mentally, there's a lot of anguish.
Yes, that's so important. We talk about that a lot. We talk about, you know, there are certain acts of sexual violence that can be criminally prosecuted. Mm-hmm. But that does not mean that all of those who don't meet that criteria, you know, what our Texas Penal Code outlines as sexual assault, that doesn't mean that those folks have not experienced sexual violence. And so that's why we use the term sexual violence, because we want to make sure we are including every survivor's experience of sexual assault, sexual violence, sexual abuse. Just because it can't be prosecuted in a court of law does not mean that it is not absolutely wrong, and doesn't mean that it can't have a profound impact on someone's life. And you're absolutely right. They are all violations of someone's autonomy, bodily autonomy, and their psychological, spiritual, and emotional selves.
Is there a range of age of people, generally speaking, who have experienced sexual assault?
So we say that sexual assault knows no boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
It can impact anyone, everywhere, no matter their age, no matter their size, their shape, their color, their, you know, socioeconomic background, what they do for a living. But we do know that there are certain ages where sexual violence is a little bit more prevalent, and that tends to be in the young adult category. So mm-hmm. those from the age of about 16 to 24 tend to experience higher rates of sexual violence. Now, keep in mind, too, you know, statistics are funny things, right? Sexual violence is the most underreported crime. So the majority of sexual violence goes unreported. So, you know, we kind of make the best guess that we can based on what is actually reported. And so what we know now is that there's a really, really high rate of sexual violence in that young adult, late teen, young adult age group.
Could you talk about those victims of sexual harassment or sexual assault who feel ashamed, and where you guys are to help those who feel either embarrassed or didn't know, but they deal with the mental anguish or they deal with the psychological trauma?
Yes. So shame and sexual violence go hand in hand. And a huge part of what we do is to work really hard to destigmatize the issue of sexual violence. And what I mean by that is to shine a light on the shame, because shame cannot live in the light, right? Mm-hmm. It breeds in the darkness. And our culture is really shaped in such a way that it blames victims for being sexually assaulted.
Yeah.
And it holds victims accountable rather than perpetrators accountable. And so that's a huge part of what we do. And, you know, we do that through community education, things like this, just talking about it, shines a light on it. And so the shame can dissipate. Also working with survivors individually through counseling, through shorter term crisis intervention and advocacy. I think just knowing that an organization like ours exists, hopefully for so many survivors, can be a shame reducer, right? Because here we are. We know that this happens. We want to tell folks you are not alone. It was not your fault. You're not the only person that this has happened to. We exist because you are not alone, and you're not the only person this has happened to, and because it's not your fault. And so, you know, we hope that that helps. But we also know shame and the emotional and psychological impact of it, you know, that doesn't go away with a snap of someone's fingers. That can take time for someone, and that's why we're here. And our services have no time limit. However long someone needs to access our counseling services or any of our services, we are here for them to walk with them along that journey. Their journey is unique in that way. And so we want to be able to be there with them every step of the way if that's what they want and that's what they need.
You know, Amy, you talked about the shame portion, but also hand in hand with the shame is the fear, because I think mm-hmm. there's a lot of victims who fear no one will believe them.
That, we hear that over and over and over again. And like I mentioned earlier, this is one of the most underreported crimes. And, you know, when asked why, we understand that that's because so many folks truly know and believe, and unfortunately this is many of their experiences, that people don't believe them.
Mm-hmm.
That they don't believe that this happened, or that they don't believe that it happened the way the survivor is saying that it happened. And that at the heart of that so often is, again, the victim blaming. Blaming that person for, why didn't you do this differently? Why were you, you know, in that club, in that car, on that date with that person? Why did
dress
you
dress that way?
Wore?
Yeah.
I mean, we think that's a cliche, right? But unfortunately, that is still the reality for so many survivors in our country, in our community. When they disclose, that is often the response that they get, is pointing at them, why didn't they do something differently? You know, and that's an exhausting way to live for anybody. But certainly after you've experienced a trauma of sexual violence, that is not a helpful response, but it's a really common one.
We're talking with Amy Jones, the CEO of the Dallas Area Rape Crisis Center. Amy, can you talk about the survivors' who become the victim again and again, and that psychological trauma. But how does a survivor wind up in a situation like that again and again? Because I know it happens.
It does. And, you know, there's some research out there to help us better understand what we would call polyvictimization or multiple types of victimization. You know, what I will say is I have personally sat with many survivors. I'm a therapist by training. Many survivors who say, do I have victim like stamped on my forehead?
Uh-huh.
Why has this happened to me again? And, you know, that's something for us to really unpack. And what I will say is, again, this can happen to anyone. But we also know that perpetrators look for vulnerability, and they look for people, they look for opportunities, right,
mm-hmm.
to exploit someone's vulnerability, which is why the ages of 16 to 24 is a really high, you know, is an age range where we see a really high rate of sexual violence. Who's more vulnerable, right, than a teenager, than a, you know, they may be out on their own, you know, they don't have perhaps the parental, you know, observation the way they did when they were mm-hmm. they were younger. It's a vulnerable time of life when they're kind of figuring out how to be an adult and how to be independent. And they don't know all the things that we as adults may know. So that is, it's a complicated answer, I guess. Like, I don't want any survivor to hear this and be like, oh my gosh, I was sexually assaulted once. That means it's going to happen to me again. It's not necessarily true. And I also don't want to tell folks that, you know, you've got to be ready all the time, on guard, because, again, that's an exhausting way to live. But we do know anecdotally and statistically that this does happen to many folks over and over. And I will say that is because of the perpetrators and their strategic plan to exploit vulnerability. You know, if we look at certain populations of folks who maybe are less likely to be believed, those are folks, you know, folks with maybe pervasive mental illness,
mm-hmm.
Our homeless neighbors. Those are folks that may be targeted by perpetrators because of the fact that they may be less likely to be believed. So it's kind of a complicated issue, but you're absolutely right. We do see it. And it is layer upon layer upon layer of trauma for some folks. And that's something we work with here at Dallas Area Rape Crisis Center, is that complex trauma. We see that all the time. We see that every day. We're prepared to support people in their healing from that.
You know, you mentioned how you help the people heal. A lot of people, unfortunately, think about sexual assault as just all about the sex, when I think a lot of people know that it's about power. It's about power by the perpetrator. And it's also about psychological dominance.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not about sex. What, you know, what we know is perpetrators of this type of crime, they're not folks who are out there who don't have access to sex, and so they're just looking for someone. This is, to your point, it is about power. It is about control over another human being. And the use of sex is a specific and intentional choice, right? Because
mm-hmm.
what more impactful way to control someone than to control them and to violate them in this incredibly vulnerable way? So that, I think, is really important for people to know and to understand. It is. It's about a mindset. It's about a belief system on the part of the perpetrator that they have the right to someone else's body in this way. And that, I think, is really important for us to know, because, again, we spend so much time looking at the victim of sexual violence and why did you do this, when really what we want to make sure we're doing is shifting toward looking at those who perpetrate this crime and holding them accountable and trying to understand why. Why do they do this, and how can we hold you accountable for this crime? We want to be spending more time looking at that and talking about that and just offering support and love and services to survivors.
We're talking with Amy Jones, the CEO of the Dallas Area Rape Crisis Center. This is a courageous conversation for those who are listening but may not be comfortable enough to talk about situations that they know about, whether it's themselves or situations that they are aware of. So I'm glad you're joining us this morning. Can you talk about, this is very uncomfortable, sexual assault that occurs in families?
Yeah. So, you know, there is this myth about sexual violence, that real sexual assault is the stranger who jumps out from behind a bush, right? With a gun, with a weapon. Now that happens. Mm-hmm. Yes, it does happen. And the media tends to really focus on those stories. But the majority of sexual violence is perpetrated by someone that the survivor knows. Maybe someone that the survivor loves, maybe someone who is very close to the survivor and in their family. And again, you know, as I mentioned earlier, perpetrators of this crime, they really capitalize on someone's vulnerability. And if you look at someone in your family, someone that you love, someone that you know, they may trust you, right? Mm-hmm. They're trusting you. So whether they're a child, certainly, who trusts someone in their family, because that's what you do, or, you know, they're another adult or a teenager, whatever their age range may be, if there is a relationship there, it is much easier to exploit that trust. And then, of course, on the other side of that is the implication and the ramifications of being harmed by someone you know and mm-hmm. someone you trust and someone you love, right? It's a lot easier. It's a lot clearer when it's like, that was a stranger. They were a monster. I don't know them. I screamed, I fought back. It's a lot harder and more complicated, and unfortunately a lot more common when it's someone that we know, when it's someone that we trust, maybe when it's someone that we love. It makes it that much harder to report the crime. And very often we hear that, right? I didn't mm-hmm. want to report. I didn't want, you know, this is someone I know and love. What they did was wrong, but I didn't want them to go to jail. That is what we work on with so many folks in counseling. Are, you know, the decisions that they felt they had to make in the aftermath of sexual violence and how complicated that can be for them. So it's not this either or, black and white, you know, this happened, certainly report it to the police. The factors can be a lot more complicating and a lot more harmful and painful.
Speaking of complications, we were talking about families. What about the situations of husbands and wives and sexual assault? I know that's very dicey and there's laws and, but I know it happens.
Yes. Thank you for bringing this up. We still have folks and who are survivors of sexual violence say, well, you know, it can't happen, right? We're married. Can't happen. We're in a committed relationship.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're living together.
Yeah. Yeah. We're in a romantic relationship. So we've had sex before. So this can't happen. It absolutely can. And it's important for us to know, I think, the history of this type of law in our country, that it wasn't until the early to mid 90s in the state of Texas where they made it explicitly clear in state law that sexual assault against a married partner was sexual assault. Prior to that, there were some loopholes there where it could not be prosecuted in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that says so much about kind of where we are in our country and the timeline of understanding sexual violence, right? I mean, that was not that long ago, couple of decades ago. And so it makes sense to me. You know, I think about my mom. I mean, for the majority of her married life, it was not a crime for her partner to sexually assault her. Mm-hmm. I think about other women my mother's age, right? It would not have been a crime. So a lot of folks are just catching up in that. And I want everyone to know, it does not matter who they are. It does not matter what their relationship to you is, their legal status with you in that relationship. If someone assaults you, if someone engages in sexual conduct with you that is not with your consent, that is absolutely sexual violence and should not have happened. And please call us if that is your story. But you're right. It can be really, really hard for people to talk about because we still have some assumptions about what consent is and that if people are married or in a relationship, that consent is a foregone conclusion. And we know that consent is an ongoing, living process. And people can retract their consent at any time, no matter the status of the relationship.
We're talking with Amy Jones, a conversation with the CEO of the Dallas Area Rape Crisis Center. This courageous conversation for a lot of people trying to figure out where they are in their situations with their bodies. Can you talk about the impact that the Me Too movement has had on the work that you do?
Oh, yeah. You know, this has been a conversation that rape crisis centers like ours have been bringing into the spotlight for decades, right? Since the 70s when the first rape crisis center was established. But this Me Too movement really, in some ways, I mean, everything has its, you know, its upsides and its downsides, but mm-hmm. it has done a lot, I think, in bringing it into more of kind of the normal day-to-day conversation. The more people see this and hear this and talk about it, the more normal it becomes, in the sense that, as you mentioned earlier, right, it's not as much kind of in the dark. It's not a conversation that people are as afraid to have.
Exactly. It's not something people internalize. They can actually discuss it, and actually it's a mental health issue, because you can therefore tell your story, and you're not keeping it inside, and it's poison inside your soul.
Yes, absolutely. It gives people more space, I think, when other folks have spoken up. It can really, really give folks a little bit more space to come alongside them and share their story, if that's what they want to do. Or even just to realize, I'm not alone. And that's the thing about this type of trauma, right? People might know that in their head. They might know, like, of course this happens to other people. But this type of trauma can feel so isolating and so alone. And this type of trauma can lie to us and tell us, you're the only one that's happened to, and nobody's going to believe you. And so for this to be a part of a national conversation, to hear this on the news, to read this on Twitter, on social media, that's really, really important, I think, and impactful for folks to recognize they are not alone, that they are a part of a large group of survivors. And that, I hope for so many folks, can bring some comfort and some peace, and help kind of point them to the next steps on their journey of recovery.
You know, and there's always a flip side. There's always those who say, well, wait a minute, she's making it up, or he's making it up. This is not true. Or the waters get blurred or muddied. I'm sure you've had to deal with some of those situations as well. I think everything, you know, is heightened when everybody's aware of stuff, right? But sometimes the he said, she said also becomes heightened.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's why this crime can be so hard to prosecute, for sure, right? Much less for people to talk about. Is, one, so many survivors are unclear about if what happened to them actually is sexual violence, right? And that's because we still have so much educating to do in our country and our culture about what consent looks like and what people's personal rights are around issues of sex and sexuality. I will say this. What I know to be true for survivors, when they do choose to go public or report, whether it's reporting to the police or disclosing to their family, it is a hard, 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 hard thing for them to do. And I do know that there are folks out there who say, oh, no, this was just, you know, a relationship gone wrong. They are, you know, this person is saying this because she wants to get back at someone. Listen, what happens to any individual when they report this crime can be another layer of trauma, right?
Mm-hmm.
Reporting it to police, it going public, people victim blaming them. I just want to encourage your listeners to understand that it is not an easy thing for someone to report this. And so we know that false reports do happen, but it's around the same rate as false reports of any other crime, which is about 2%.
Correct.
So that, I think, is something important for us all to recognize and to remember. My gosh, if somebody is going to go through what they go through after they report a sexual violence, and it wasn't true, my goodness.
Yeah, the character assassination.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, we start from a place of believing survivors, because, you know, when somebody runs up and says, my gosh, I was carjacked, somebody took my car at gunpoint, we believe them. We start from a place of believing them until we have reason to think otherwise. And we've done that differently with sexual violence, right? In our culture, in our community, we start from a place of unbelief. And our goal is to shift that, start from a place of a belief, because typically, the majority of the time, absolutely true. In fact, 98% of the time, it's absolutely true. So why wouldn't we start from a place of belief?
You've been involved with the Dallas Area Rape Crisis Center for a while now. Can you give us a feel-good story or two? Because, you know, a lot of people who want to maybe reach out to you, they understand certain consequences, but sometimes they don't know some of the benefits that may happen to them. And can you give us an example or two?
Sure. So we hear stories all the time from survivors from some of our former clients, right, who send notes to their counselors and say, you know, I was able to go on a date for the first time in months or years.
Mm-hmm.
and have a conversation without thinking about what happened to me. You know, I was able to have a conversation about safety and consent with my teenager. And that was, you know, really important and impactful and profound. You know, I was able to go back to work, you know, for the first time in months after this happened to me, because I'm not afraid to leave my house. So we hear these stories on a daily basis. Of course, there are the stories of the survivors who, you know, perhaps they did decide to report to the police and it did make it through the criminal justice system and the perpetrator saw, you know, accountability through the criminal justice system. But more often than not, what we hear and what we see are those survivors who come to us and say, I was able to regain a quality of life that I didn't think that I was going to get to have. You know, a couple of years ago during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, our hotline saw this enormous increase in the number of callers, and they were women in their late 40s, 50s, and 60s, much like Dr. Blasey Ford, who, similar in age range, who started calling our hotline and saying, I've never told anyone this. Mm-hmm. I've never told anyone what happened to me when I was in high school. You know, it's impacted my marriage. It's impacted my relationship with my kids. It's impacted, you know, my relationships with friends and my community and what I think about myself and how I feel about myself. I've never told anyone. And they chose to call our hotline and tell us for the first time. So what I will say is, while we know that sexual violence is profoundly impactful, can change someone's life from the inside out, I also believe that survivors of sexual violence, especially those who call our hotline and walk through our doors, are some of the most resilient and some of the strongest folks that we have ever seen, that I have ever gotten to know or work with. Because what we see and what we know over and over and over again is that healing is possible. Recovering from something like this is absolutely possible. Creating a beautiful life for yourself in the aftermath of sexual violence is absolutely possible. And that's the message I want everyone to know and I want everyone to take away with. For whoever's listening who feels like maybe, you know, their life is over, they're never going to feel like themselves again, I want them to know and I want them to hear that it is absolutely possible for them to recover and to find a life that is meaningful and is beautiful, that they can sleep, that they can have relationships, mm-hmm. That they won't always think about this thing that happened in their life.
Amy, you guys do such great work. Can you share with us how they can reach you at the Dallas Area Rape Crisis Center? Websites, phone numbers, whatever you suggest.
Absolutely. So the best way to reach us is to call our hotline, 972-641-7273. That's a 24/7 hotline that your call will be answered by a staff member or volunteer who is trained and prepared to answer any question that you have and to respond to you with care and compassion. You can also hop on our website. So it's DallasRapeCrisis.org. You can get involved. You can find out what services we offer. You can sign up to become a volunteer with us. You can see the events that we've got going on throughout the weeks and months upcoming. There's so many ways for you to be engaged with the work that we do or to receive services from us. So we just want folks to know that we're here and we're here for our community. All of our services are free of charge. We want to make sure there's no barrier for anyone receiving our services. So please call us today, 972-641-7273.
Amy, amazing work and a great, courageous conversation. We got to have you on again real soon and update and remind everyone that you guys are doing the great work that you are. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us right now is a longtime friend of mine who is the CEO and founder of Minnie's Food Pantry, Miss Cheryl Jackson. How you doing, Cheryl?
Chris, I'm fantastic. How are you today?
I am doing just great. And you have been doing so many wonderful things with Minnie's Food Pantry. In fact, I even said the name wrong. It's the award-winning Minnie's Food Pantry. Can you tell all of our listeners?
Oh, stop it.
Well, it's true. It's true. You guys have done such a wonderful job providing food for not only school kids, homeless families, anyone who would need some kind of food in the North Texas area. You have won awards and acclaim and been on Oprah and Good Morning America. I could go on and on and on, but I'm going to start from the beginning. Can you tell everyone who's listening all about Minnie's Food Pantry and how you first started?
Oh, Chris, I'd be honored. So Minnie's Food Pantry is named after my mother. Her name was Minnie Hawthorne Ewing. And I was the child of two PKs, if people know what that means. That's preacher's kids.
Yes, sir.
And
yes, ma'am.
I grew up with, like, you know, seven kids in the house. And my parents just always taught us about giving back. And they gave on the level in which they had. And my father died suddenly, Father's Day weekend, 2004. And there was a point in my life personally, Chris, where my husband and I collectively were working five jobs and we couldn't make ends meet. And so I went and applied for food stamps because I'm like, I have these kids and I don't know, you know, how I'm going to feed them. And it was the most horrific experience I'd ever encountered. And I just thought to myself, there has to be a better way. There has to be a better way. And I said on the journey, you know, saying, okay, I'll figure it out. And then life got better for me. I started working for Emmett Smith and I was doing the red carpet. I won a red carpet experience with Fox to interview people on the red carpet at the Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
And things just turned around. And then my dad died suddenly, Father's Day weekend, 2004. And I went into this huge depression and I lived across the street from my parents. And so one day my mother came over and she's like, you've got to get up. You know, she goes, you're going to die if you stay in the state. And I literally got down to about 110 pounds. And I said, I don't care because I'll see my dad again. I was that depressed. And then I looked over my mom. She goes, but you've got to live for your kids. And I said, well, then, Mom, I said, I'll try. I said, but you're all I have left. So I want the world to know your name because I just love my parents that much. And so I said, I know what I'll do. I got this whisper. I said, what can I do? And it said, you know, feed the hungry. Treat people how you wanted to be treated when you needed a meal. So I went on this journey, Chris. I had literally nothing. I looked at my mom. I said, I'm going to start a food pantry. I'm going to name it after you. And she's like, you don't have to do that. I said, yeah. I said, I'm going to feed the hungry. And I literally started with two cans of corn, and I had the first and last month's rent. And everybody around me was just saying, you know, there is no need. I was living in Plano, suburban, you know, mm-hmm. America. There's nobody hungry. But I knew there were people hungry because at my lowest point, I would strategically go to people whom I loved to their homes when it was time for dinner because I knew they would feed my children. And that's all that I cared about. And I said, so there's somebody else out there probably just like me. And so we started with two cans of corn in a little small 500 square foot building. And it was tough. I mean, we went door to door. People would donate things to me because when I applied for food stamps, I just remember the smell of the place. I remember the tears from myself and the people who were there because you didn't want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I remember getting declined. And the most important thing I remember was that when I was declined for food stamps, because I made, I think it was $8 more than what I should make to be able to get it, they gave me this brown paper bag. It was, I guess, an emergency food bag. And I was so grateful. But when I got home and opened it up, I didn't recognize anything. Everything was expired. And the only thing I remember were beets. And I still haven't cooked beets to this day. I just remember crying.
Oh, I understand.
Yeah. Yeah. I just remember crying and going, oh, my gosh. And so when I started the food pantry, then I said, I have to do something that I want to treat people the way my mother and father taught me about treating people when they needed a meal. And I want to educate people about hunger because I was hungry. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did.
You know, you say that and you say it like it was just so easy, but I know it was more difficult than that. Once you started this thing up, I know there were times, in fact, I'm going to go ahead and jog your memory. I know there were times where natural disasters affected you, and I think you actually got Mark Cuban to help you out.
I did. Well, you know, in 2009, like I'm trying my best just to make it, right?
Right.
And we had finally got a nice little donation going from December into the new year. And I just was like, okay, I'm good. I'll go over the Christmas holidays and I'll be okay. And then there was a terrible snowstorm. And I just remember the roofs collapsing over all my buildings. I had two little buildings and it destroyed all of my food. And I sat there in that building and I was just rocking back and forth and crying. I was like, I know that God had told me to feed the hungry. And now an act of God has destroyed all of my food. And I was like, who can help me? And so I just started calling people. And Mark Cuban, because I'm an MFFL all for life. I called Mark Cuban. I was emailing him and trying to tweet at him and everything else saying, I need you to help me. And he never answered. And then the news got wind of my story and how the food had been destroyed. And one of the camera persons stepped in front of me and he said, you should smile as though Mark Cuban just donated $10,000 to you. And I went back and emailed Mark Cuban because I'm crying, right? Mm-hmm. I went back and emailed Mark Cuban. I said, Mark, I know you're supposed to help me because the newsman just confirmed. He told me to smile as though you give me $10,000. And lo and behold, like an hour later, I get a phone call from Mark's assistant, and he donated $10,000. And he literally saved. That was the first donation that helped save Minnie's Food Pantry, or we wouldn't be in existence today. We would not be in existence. And he didn't want his name to be told. He just was like, I'm just happy to do it. Keep doing your mission. Then a man named Moses came and gave. So I said, okay, God, you sent Mark Cuban and you sent Moses. You know, I get this now. I'm supposed to be doing it. And so, you know, our journey continued. And we started in a little 500-square-foot building, you know, feeding 10, 15 people a week, up to 100 people a month. And for our protein, it was peanut butter. But I had bigger dreams and I had bigger visions because I remembered what I wanted and what I needed. And my vision ultimately was to give people complete healthy meals, which included meats and fruits and vegetables, et cetera. And the other thing I said is when people would come and donate, because they'd heard about me, they would give me expired food. And I always said I never wanted the feeling of when I saw that expired food to go away. Mm-hmm. So I would tell people, close your eyes and open them. And if the person you're standing in front of, the person you love the most, was standing in front of you, is this what you would want me to give them? And it kind of brought a awareness of hunger. And people will go, oh, okay, I get it. Because I was like, I don't want this. This is expired. And people will be like, well, if someone needs a meal, they should just be happy. And that's not what I thought. I said, if they need a meal, they're at the lowest point in their lives. And so we began the red carpet experience where we literally went, got a red carpet. Because I remember being on the red carpet at the Oscars. And I said, imagine when you walk in and your head is down and you see a red carpet rolled out for you. And then you look up and you see someone wearing maybe a free hug shirt because Miss Minnie always gave free hugs. And then it smells great because my mother always kept a clean house, so I would have candles going. And then we always had music piped in because my mother, we had 7 kids. Mm-hmm. We would sing all the time. And so that's the place and the space that I created called Minnie's. And you can't duplicate it because it's such an energy and an aura. And it's about people who've either been there or they get it. And so when you walk on the property of Minnie's Food Pantry, it's a different experience altogether from any food experience, pantry experience you'll probably ever have because we really, really care. We don't work. We really don't work for a living. We do this because it is our passion, and we are commanded to do it and treat people how we want it to be treated.
Cheryl, you kind of touched on this a little bit about how you started and the space was so small. Now, for those who don't know, you have a campus. You have a really, really nice facility, and you have food trucks that go out. Can you talk about your staff, how people have been able to find you and work with you, and what's the process of how you get the food to some of the people who need it?
Thank you for asking that. Yeah, so what happened is when we started, it's really amazing how we grew because I tell people don't despise small beginnings. Because we started in 500-square-foot building around a major grocery store. And we were in suburban America where Willow Bend and all that area, if you're familiar with it, mm-hmm. So the wealthy people had to come to that grocery store. Well, right by that grocery store was a food pantry. And right in front of that food pantry was a line. And I figured either they're going to help me feed the hungry or they will turn their heads.
Very
smart. Which one will they do?
Very smart.
Right. Yeah. And so then the grocery store, when I got ready to renew my lease after 3 years, my realtor said, the grocery store said, if I renew your lease, they won't renew theirs. And of course, I'm in 500 square foot. They're so big. And so I started crying and I went across the street. I'm like, where am I going to go? Because we had to be strategic. We had to be on a bus line because people were riding the buses to get to us. I went across the street and a place had become available just like the week prior. And it was double the occupancy of what I was currently at. And I was like, how am I going to do this? Because it was just me. I knew nothing. It was all grassroots. I learned from heart and from pain. That's how I learned how to build Minnie's. And so I took up on myself, and the guy goes, well, Cheryl, there is a building there, and it was triple the rent that I was already paying. And I was like, God, I can't even pay this. But he was like, just go and do. And I said, okay. So I signed the rent, and I just I mean, just from vision, mm-hmm. I signed the rent there because where it was located, it was based kind of off the highway. So the guy was like, I'll give you a little discount, but it was still triple what I was already paying. But people find me. It's like if you feed them, they will come, mm-hmm. right? People begin to find me there. And when my lease, and that was about almost like 2,000-3,000 square feet. And so I was like, wow, they found me there. And then when my lease was up, the guy saw that the people found me. So he says, I'm going to renew your lease, but he was going to charge me double. So here I go crying again, Chris. I'm like, God, I can't pay this. I barely was able to pay this. So at every place that I went to, I was literally pushed out of that place. I wasn't trying to go and pay more, but this guy wouldn't pay my rent. He wouldn't renew at the normal amount.
Right.
And so I ended up having to go to another place right across the street. So I was in Park on Parker and Independence in all three corners because I was still trying to be on the bus line. And I find it amazing, not ironic, but amazing that God would open up a place every time in the same corner when my rent was due and I had to go to a different place. You know, my lease is up. So I found another place, Chris. And my last place, it was about, I started off with 3,000 square feet, and then they gave me another 3,000. And so when I finally ended, it was about 10,000 square feet that we had. And once again, the realtor comes in and says they're not going to renew your lease. They want the place because they see all of these volunteers. And so you were talking about how the volunteers, we boast about having over 30,000 volunteers in our database. Before COVID hit, Chris, we had over 6 months waiting period for people to come volunteer because
wow.
Corporate America, yeah, we created that space and place. We call it the happy place where corporate America was like, my people need to experience this. They need to experience mm-hmm. all
this is where they can volunteer.
Building.
This is where they can give
yes,
back.
They can give back. And I mean, when I tell you the community rose up and has arisen to give back to us, I mean, it's in like masses and droves. And so we were really, really blessed. So when the time came for me to renew that lease, the guy said, well, I see all these cars. And I said, sir, the cars you see are my corporate volunteers. I said, and then the people you see are the people that I'm feeding the hungry. And he was like, well, I'm going to triple your rent. So here I go again, Chris. And on the day he came to tell me that, there was a gentleman who only volunteers one time out of the year. His name was Bill Cawley of Cawley Partners. He's a builder. And he said, why are you looking like this? I said, because this guy's here to tell me he's not going to renew my lease. And lucky for me, the realtor had already told me that and showed me a new place. And Bill went to the new place that we're currently in. And he said, did God say this is your place? I said, yes. He said, then I will buy it. And you just pay me back when you can. And so at every place, and now I boast that we are in 28,000 square feet. We have three separate buildings. We have a beautiful boutique where all of these different people donate to us. Neiman Marcus, Macy's, all of these places donate to us, and we sell their stuff at like 80% off. When Neiman Marcus closed down, they donate, and every dollar that you spend, it's our social enterprise. Every dollar you spend, it goes toward three meals for someone else. And then we have a mini life learning lab where we were teaching the kids. So we went from just feeding them to saying, how do we teach them? So we were bringing in and chartering buses of school kids and teaching them philanthropy and teaching them about healthy eating so that they wouldn't have to come to a pantry and teaching them about banking so that they will be, you know, self-sustaining.
Sure.
We got to cut off that break and that generational curse and that gap.
Yeah, break the cycle.
Yeah, break the cycle, right. And then COVID hit. And when COVID hit, everything changed.
Oh, I got to hear this. Tell us what happened to Minnie's Pantry. We're talking with Cheryl Jackson here on Better Living about Minnie's Food Pantry. COVID hits, then what happened?
COVID hits, and it changes everything. We go from serving now, remember I said originally 100 people a month. We were then serving 5,000 people a month before COVID hit. When COVID hit, it changed, completely changed the face of hunger, even more than what I used to say. And we went from serving 5,000 people a month to 30,000 people a month.
Wow.
From 5,000 to 30,000.
How were you able to come up with the inventory, and how were you able to get it to the people?
Well, and that's what was so important is that we were able, I had 17 people on my staff. We went to a 7-day work week, and I said, still, there's no way we can meet this demand. And then there was a company, a nonprofit who supplied, who hired restaurant workers who were out of jobs, and it was funded by Mark Cuban. And I said, I need help. And they gave me 52 employees for almost a year that they paid for. Wow. 52 employees. And these employees helped us. And then, of course, the community just rose up. Everything that we need, from the farmers to the government, gave all of those fresh food boxes, all those things you saw. We were able to acquire those. They gave meat boxes. And so people would come in and they would get, you know, 20 pounds of meat, 20 pounds of fruits and vegetables, and then all the non, you know, perishable things that they needed to go with the meal. Mm-hmm. And I just cried, because every time we needed something, somebody stepped up right on that day. Kids, the schools, the Plano schools and McKinney schools were like, we need food for our families. And I saw people come through in our community, and they started doing food drives and donating the snacks. And it just all was like a Disney movie, with Minnie as the main character, but Minnie was my mom, you know? And I just was like, and then right before COVID hit, you know, Chris, my mother passed away. It'll be 5 years Mother's Day weekend. Suddenly, she died of a heart attack. And so as I close this interview, I'll tell you about the last conversation I had with her. She told me, she said, I'm so proud of you. And we were talking about building a mini food pantry in Dallas. And so she said, I can't believe you're going to do it. I can't believe you love me so much. And I said, Mom, I promise you I'm going to build that building. I was in a meeting, went into a meeting, turned my phone over. When I turned it back over, I missed so many calls. When I returned the call, my mother had had a heart attack and passed away. And I was devastated. I went in a depression again, and I was sitting in my bed just crying. And I told my husband, I said, I can't go on. I was getting ready to do a press conference saying I'm going to close down Minnie's. And I said, God, if I'm supposed to keep doing this, please give me a sign. And I look at my phone, it goes bing. And it's a text message from Oprah Winfrey. She said, I didn't know your mom passed. She said, I want to donate $100,000 in her name. And I was down $100,000. Then Mark Cuban found out that Oprah donated $100,000. He donated, of course, 101, right?
Yes, I was there for that one.
And then Mark Burnett and Roma Downey, they donated $100,000. And these people became the wind beneath my wings, if you will. And I said, okay, I believe I'll run on. But then Oprah, I called her. She called me. And we were talking, and I just said, Oprah, I said, you know, for years I've been putting a place setting out saying you will come and you will support me, and I need your help. I said, I don't have a voice right now because my mother is gone. She was my best friend. I said, will you be my voice? And I just waited. And she said, okay. She said, but what do you need? I said, right now I need $250,000. She said, I'll give you that. And she said, I said, but I need you to be my voice. She said, I just gave you $250,000, but it was so many people we're feeding. She goes, that won't work. I said, no, girl, I need you to come to Texas. And she paused for a moment, and then she said, Cheryl, I'll come. And when she arrived, she just told people how she watched me for 8 years start with two cans of corn, and how, you know, we've managed to get our name. Rihanna came and volunteered with us. Jim Parsons from the Big Bang Theory has volunteered, you know. Pat Nemeth Smith and Mark Cuban and Devin and all of these.
Devin Harris, yeah.
Yeah, Devin Harris.
The whole Dallas Mavericks team came one night.
The coach, yes.
Coach Carlisle.
Yeah, Phil Carlisle. All of them came.
Dirk, everybody.
Dirk, I know. When I saw Dirk, I was like, okay, I hit jackpot. Because you have to understand, I was the only girl. I had five brothers, one sister, and everybody loved the Lakers. So you know back in the day what I had to go through. And so when they arrived at our gala, I told my family, I said, and this is why I am a Mavericks fan for life, because none of your Lakers are going to come out here. You know, and that was a joke, you know, throughout our family. But it was just such an honor to have them there supporting and understanding that hunger is everywhere and the face of a hunger has changed. And it is our goal at Minnie's Food Pantry to educate people that someone next to you could be hungry, but they're smiling. And so look into their eyes, and when you ask how are they doing, stop to really get the answer. And that's what we do at Minnie's. And we roll out the red carpet. We treat people with dignity, integrity, and respect. And as we move forward right now, we are preparing Minnie's Food Pantry. I bought the promised land where I told my mom I would build. Mm-hmm. And in the next year, we already have the plans at the city of Dallas. We are waiting anxiously for them to approve our plans. And as I promised to my mom, and it's coming up on her 5-year anniversary, I am going to build on the promised land. And I will build in Dallas, and we will celebrate the woman whose name is Minnie and the legacy that thousands of people have come to honor her as they serve at our pantry. We now have Minnie's Food Pantry in Plano. We will have one in Dallas. We have one in Houston, Texas. We have one in New York City. Mm-hmm. We have one in Pennsylvania. And I see globally Minnie's being erupted everywhere, worldwide. But right now, my focus is on the promised land and the promise I made my mother.
You know, yeah. Cheryl, this is an amazing story. And I swear this is something that's actually touching a lot of people's hearts because, again, you're doing more than just feeding people. You're providing an opportunity for those who have to give back or to volunteer. And you're creating situations where those who are hungry can break out of the vicious cycle and can educate themselves and not be in the situation where they are right now, where they are hungry. Can you elaborate a little bit about how you were able to think these things through? Because I know you were able to make some contacts. Again, you reached out and you're able to touch Mark Cuban. You reached out and you used to do some things with Emmett and Pat Smith, and you were able to say, okay, let me see if I can't get you guys to help me with this. I said all of that to also say, how in the world did you ever meet Oprah? People, I mean, she's the one, and if she blesses your organization, it's almost like it's going to happen unless you just totally screw it up.
Exactly. I met Oprah. I was watching her show one day, and she was like, you know, have you had it? She goes, this is what I want you to do. Write down everything that you want to do in life. She said, and then go after it. She said, write down the top 10 things you want. I was watching her show, and I was crying, and I was writing, and I was like, I want to interview Oprah. I want to interview Will Smith. I want to interview. I want to have my own TV show. I want to have my own radio show. I want to have my own newspaper column. And then at the end, she's like, now go after it. And I had no college background. I graduated at 17, got married at 17. And I was like, but how do I get my own newspaper column? And this guy, he was with the Minority Opportunity News that was in Plano. Mm-hmm. It probably reached about 2,000 people, but that didn't matter to me. If I could get a newspaper column, I'm checking off one thing. So I went to him and I said, I'm supposed to have my own newspaper column. He goes, show me some of your work. I'd never written before, Chris, in my life. And I was like, well, I don't have anything, but I'm supposed to have my own newspaper column and I'm going to interview Oprah. And if you don't hire me, then my column is going to be in your competitions page. And he thought that was so funny. He did. And he hired me. And do you know what? That was the first year Oprah did Live Your Best Life. She took it on the road.
Oh, yeah, the magazine.
The magazine, yes. And the conference is like a tour where 3,000 women get together. And I looked at my mom and I said, she's doing this. We got to go. And it was in Florida. And me and 7 other people went with me because they thought I was crazy. And Oprah said, don't ask me for anything. She said, and, you know, and she started talking about Texas. And I was telling people, I'm going to interview her all throughout the time I was there. And she said, don't tell me about Texas because they, you know, they sued me in Texas. And the lady touched me.
Oh, yeah.
Said, didn't you? Yeah, she goes, didn't you say you're from Texas? You forget about it, right? And so throughout different times, Oprah would say, if you have a question, raise your hand. Well, I was the last person that she called on. She goes, you, what's your question? And I said, Oprah, I just want to validate. You told everybody to write down what you want to do. And I had my top 10 things I written down. I said, one of them was to have my own newspaper article. And here it is. I said, so would you think about it and pray about it and let me interview you? And there was a hush over the room. And she looked at me.
Because that's bold.
That's real bold. And I had tears just locking. She goes, I'll do it. And Gail comes running from behind, grabs me up, takes me in. She goes, do you realize what you've landed? I was like, yeah. She goes, what are you going to ask her? I said, I don't know. And so I get to the back. She sits down. They put these beautiful flowers up as though it was already planned, and it wasn't. And she says, now, ask me anything. And I go, I'm crying still, Chris. And I'm like, because this is my first interaction with her. I go, why did you do it? And she said, because our spirits connected. She said, what do you love to do? And I said, well, I love to give. That's what I love to do. And she said, okay. She said, then pursue that. Pursue your passion. She said, Cheryl, and your passion is doing that you would do, even if you weren't paid to do it. So go do it. And when people tell you no, you tell them you got to Oprah, so you really don't need them. I was like, yes, ma'am, you know. And I had that. I didn't verbally say that to very many people unless they were rude to me. Mm-hmm. But in the back of my mind, when people would tell me no, I would always put a T on the end and say, not yet. And I would be thinking opposite because I got to Oprah. I know I can get to you. And so I just never took no for an answer. I just don't believe in the word no.
Very persistent.
I say, people say N-O because because they K-N-O-W. They don't know, so that's why they say the word no. But when I educate you on the opportunity that you have to change a life in some form or fashion, and you know that you're providing something as simple as a meal and it could only cost you $1, most people say, how can I help? Period.
Yes, they really
do. They connect to the soul and the passion, and that's what we're about.
We're talking with Cheryl Jackson, the CEO of Minnie's Food Pantry, about the adventures and how you've gotten this organization to where it is today. I got to throw in another adventure, because you called me up one day a few years ago and said you had won a movie screening, a Hollywood movie screening for your neighborhood, courtesy of Good Morning America. And you asked me, can I come and like MC the red carpet, and can I bring some people with me? And I called up Tony Romo, and he brought his entire neighborhood with him, all the kids from his neighborhood and his wife, and a couple of the Dallas Mavericks, Michael Finley. But you have Rihanna with you. Tell me that story, because, first of all, I never did hear exactly how you won a movie screening in your own neighborhood on Good Morning America, and you were on Good Morning America, and then Rihanna was there.
Okay, so, Chris, I hadn't taken a day off from Minnie's in, like, 6 years or whatever. It was during the snowstorm, and I was cooking, which I feed the hungry, but I very seldom cook in my house. And I dropped a pan of bacon grease on my foot. I had third-degree burns.
Oh,
I went to Parkland. My mother's like, you got to go figure this out, because it was just blistering really bad. And the doctor says, we need to do surgery, but they didn't have any openings. He sent me back home and said, you cannot get on your feet. You must sit down. I was sitting in my bed with my PJs on and a bonnet on my head, and it says, are you a hometown hero? Do you do something for your community? If so, Good Morning America wants to bring the new movie Home, featuring Rihanna, Steve Martin, and Jim Parsons, to your neighborhood. Write and tell us what you're doing.
Oh, yeah, the animated movie. Yes, Home.
Yes.
I think all little kids watch it now.
Yes, they did. And so I just looked up and I hit the thing on my computer and I said, hi, my name is Cheryl Jackson. I'm the founder of Minnie's. And if you want to bring a red carpet, that would go with us, because we literally roll out the red carpet to feed the hungry. I said, stop watching videos. I'm your girl. You need to choose me, because I feed the hungry. And I'm hungry to meet all of them and tell them about what we do in a wonderful city called Plano, Texas. Pick me. That's all I said. I have on a head bonnet, Chris, and my PJ. What I later found out. So they chose me, and I didn't even know it. And they surprised me. If you look it up, you'll see me just because I'm in a boot, and they tell me I have to go to work early. And I'm like, okay. And I'm in the room. And then when I walk back out, like about an hour later, there's Good Morning America with this big, huge screen. And I see Rihanna and Steve Martin and Jim Parsons out there. And then I see that they'd had a parade of people out there when the red carpet rolled out for me. And I knew when I walked out that door, I just fell to my knees. I was like, Mom, I won! And it was 246 media outlets out there that day. I didn't even know the Rihanna. All I knew was Shine Bright Like a Diamond. That was the only song I knew. But I tell you what, we shined that day. And then I was able to interview. They let me be the purple carpet because it was purple. So I was a purple carpet host for Entertainment Tonight. I got to interview Jennifer Lopez, Viola Davis, of course, Rihanna. And then Rihanna spent the day with me. They flew me in a day early, and I sat with Rihanna for probably 3 or 4 hours. And I literally have her on videotape saying, will you adopt me? She goes, there's just something about you that I need in my life. Please adopt me. And I have her on video saying that and talking about the hungry. It was just a moment that I will never forget. And yeah, and I owe that to, you know, my fans as well, the people who love Minnie so much that they speak our name. But on this particular time, I got injured, and they told me that the video I submitted it the day of the end of the entries. So if a doctor wouldn't have told me not to go to work, I would have missed it.
You would have missed the deadline.
The day that it ended, I'd have missed the deadline. Yeah.
You are living an amazing life, but you are also doing so many wonderful things for so many people. You are a whirlwind, and that's why people can't say no. And it's such a worthy cause. Can you tell people how they could possibly be involved with Minnie's Pantry, what they can do if they wanted to donate or donate their time or partner with you? And again, I want to congratulate you again on all of the success you've been having.
Thank you, Chris. And thank you so much for using your platform as well to to speak our name. I remember being honored by the Dallas Mavericks as a community award person and how you mm-hmm. came over and just showed me mad love all throughout the years. And, you know, that's what I say. I didn't do this alone. I did it because a lot of people connected with me. My mother would call me the gatherer. And I just happened to
gather
a lot of people. Thank you. Thank you. And so my goal is just to gather enough people that will speak about hunger so that we won't end it, but we can reduce it in our community. And that's our goal every single day that we wake up. And so if people want to join us, they can go to minniesfoodpantry.org, and that's spelled M-I-N-N-I-E-S, foodpantry.org. And you can donate your time, your talent, or I say treasure. What I mean by time is that's volunteering. We just opened back up to start volunteering, so you can hit volunteer at Minnie's Food Pantry. But you'll learn all of that on our website. Or your talent, meaning that if you do web design or just something your company can offer to us, you know, as an in-kind donation, you can find out there. And then, of course, your treasures, which is donations of dollars. If you want to donate a dollar, every dollar that you donate provides 3 meals to our community. And we're celebrating 13 years, so we just ask everybody to do $13 minimum a month. So if you think you can do that, that will be providing over 39 meals every month to people in our community. And thank you again, Chris, for having me on.
Cheryl, we're so proud of you, and you're absolutely amazing. We've got to do this again, maybe in the fall, okay?
I would love that, sir. Have a great day.
All right, Cheryl Jackson from Minnie's Food Pantry. I'm Chris Arnold from 105.3 The Fan. Thanks for joining me. Tune in next week as we focus on other organizations doing great things in our community right here on Better Living.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track 4 games at once with multi-view mode. And catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.